Much. Nice to see a wide array of individuals today. We're going to begin by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 327, a little out of order, and ask Senator Morris if you'd like to introduce his constituent. Is that right?
Who?
It's Asena, his constituent.
No. Senate Bill 327?
327, okay.
Yep.
Frank Morris.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name for the record is Frank Morris, State Senator from District 8, representing Albany and Corvallis. And accompanying me today is a constituent, Jan Amling, and she will be providing testimony as well. I filed this bill at the request of Jan, and that I would like to just very briefly touch on provisions of the bill, and then in terms of the need for the bill, would have that explained by Jan. This is a bill that authorizes a nonprofit organization to charge a fee, the fee to be set by the Director of Department of Consumer and Business Services, to cover expenses of the credit counseling if the debt consolidating agency demonstrates to the director the need for the fee, or the credit counseling is required by rule or order of a federal or state agency, and the debt consolidating agency is certified by the federal or state agency to provide the credit counseling, and a request to charge the fee has been approved in writing by the director. Now, I have delivered to you proposed amendments for Section 3, and those amendments state a debt consolidating agency may not charge or receive from a client a fee authorized under ORS 697.692 for any services provided by the agency to the client before the agency provides the disclosure required under this section. And I think this is the key issue in this bill, is the disclosure. I would point out to you that there is no prohibition against providing free counseling at this point in the juncture. And I think as the explanation will go on, you'll understand why the need for the bill. A debt consolidating agency shall disclose in writing to each client on a separate form, one, the maximum amount the debt consolidating agency may charge for services, and two, that the client is responsible for payment of the amount charged. And then there must be a space for signing so that there's an acknowledgement that the amount of the fee has been determined and that it will be paid. And I would like to ask Jan if she would explain in greater detail why this bill is necessary.
Thank you. Welcome. Introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. My name is Jan Amling, and I'm the Executive Director of Consumer Credit Counseling Service. I understand that you're under a time crunch today, and I wonder if you wanted me to read you the testimony or try to give you a very brief capsulized version of what's happening.
Give us a capsulized version. We do have the written testimony. So.
Okay. We're a not-for-profit agency, and we operate under the guidelines of the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, and my testimony explains all the hoops that we have to jump through to be a member of that. Unfortunately, not all of the 42 debt consolidating agencies in Oregon are members of the NFCC or live by those guidelines. But the ORS 697 is very specific about the fees that we may charge in our industry. There may not be a charge for any conversation that does or does not result in a debt repayment plan, which means we cannot charge for counseling. We may charge a $25 setup fee for those families that are going to use the debt repayment plan. And for the people that do use the debt repayment plan, we may charge a fee of up to 15% of the funds that they bring us. For instance, if you brought me $1,000 a month to pay on your debts, I could, by law, charge you a fee of $150 every month. In our The CCCS offices, the ones that are members of the National Foundation, usually cap that at $35 a month. So we're way under what the law is specifying. What's happening is that the federal bankruptcy law, Senate, I think it's 256, has passed the Senate. It has passed the House committee and is due to be heard, we think, on the floor on April 7th. If that bill passes, there are two ways that that's going to affect our agencies. We are pretty much designated as the provider of choice of that service because of the way it is spelled out, the types of services that have to be offered by the place that you go for this. But there would be a front-end piece that before you can file, you need to take with you to file for the bankruptcy a document saying that you've been in for counseling and have learned what the alternatives are to bankruptcy, and also we've worked out a realistic budget for you to live on. At the back end, before the bankruptcy can be discharged, then the family has to go someplace such as our agency or other types of places for an educational piece so that they'll learn how not to get into trouble again. So in previous legislation, we have the ability to charge for educational pieces. So I'm not here to talk about that. I'm here to talk about the front-end piece, the certificate that they have to take when they file for the bankruptcy. So the way the federal law is being written, the families are going to be directed to us, but by your laws, we have no way to charge for that service. And there's no means in the federal bankruptcy legislation to pay for it. So we need to have some funding to be able to do this. And we've talked to the DCBS to see if they would be willing to be the gatekeeper to determine what would be a reasonable fee. And, of course, we can't decide that until the law passes and the trustees decide what the range of fees are going to be in this region. So it's not appropriate for me to try and get you to approve some fee, but for DCBS to have the hearing and determine what would be reasonable. So that is one component. That is the need for being able to charge a counseling fee. There are some bad players in our industry, and typically what some of them have done is to take the first month's deposit and use it for their own fee, which violates your laws already because they've taken more than the $25 setup fee, or they've taken more than the 15%. They've taken 100% of that first fee. DCBS has been very good about trying to get that money back for families, but this law does have a phrase that addresses that it would be illegal to retain a fee until you have disperse the money to the creditors first. So it gives an extra hook for the state to be able to enforce that. And then the third component, the one that Senator Morris was addressing, having to do with the disclosure of fees and to have it in writing so that the family knows what the maximum fees will be. And this says that you may have the counseling, but before any fee is assessed, that you will have in writing what the fees will be, and you acknowledge it by signing for it. So that's basically what we're asking for.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Questions? I think I'm clear on that. I'm going to ask now, we have one person sign up in opposition. I can't quite read. I apologize. It looks like Lewis Finley. Well, come on. If you would come forward. And if you guys just want to stand down for a second, okay. We'll have Lewis comment because we may have a question after his testimony.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Thank you very much. I would point out that this very same bill passed out of the House last session, and it died in the horse trading process in the Senate. So this is not new territory that we're plowing here today. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Horses were traded.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Horses. Yeah. I don't remember any horses? But. We should actually get some actual horses. Yeah. Trade them. Yeah. I like having a horse. Yeah, I'll trade.
You have any good to trade?
I can get a horse. You get a horse?
Liger.
I'll do a lot for Liger.
Two horses for Liger.
Horse and a pony.
And Mr. Finney, I'll, because of our agenda today, I'm going to tell you the same thing I did the proponents, and rather than read your testimony, if you could highlight why you feel this would not be a good idea.
Well, I guess I covered it pretty much in this, but if I jump away from it, I think that it's a horrible letdown for the state of Oregon.
Would you please identify yourselves again, please?
My name is Lewis M. Finley, F-I-N-L-E-Y.
Thank you.
And I think it's a horrible thing for this to happen, to set up a non-profit company and offer people something for nothing. And then, because of bad advertising and economics, turn around and start charging them for all the things they used to say was evil. I think this is kind of a let down the people who set this bill in motion. I think that's wrong. I think one of the things that might be characterized at what's going on, I think what I object to most is that we've made a distinction here between profit-making companies and non-profit-making companies. And I think that's completely wrong. I think it's characterized by an ad or by an article I saw in the paper today. Let me fish it out here for a second. I think you'll find it on the back of your packet. We see this sort of thing going on in the country, and it alarms us somewhat. This is from the Oregonian today. It says, debt relief firms settle fraud charges. It says, I'll synopsize. I know you don't want me to take the time to read it all. But it says, the Federal Trade announced Wednesday that three consumer debt companies have settled charges that they cheated financially strapped customers out of more than $100 million. The agency said that the National Consumer Council of California, Debt Management Foundation Services, and so on, agreed to repay $6 million in consumer redress for falsely promising easy debt relief that left many customers deeply in debt and sometimes forced them to file for bankruptcy protection. All three lied about who they were, what they could do for consumers, and what they charged, said such and such. The action is part of an ongoing FTC campaign against unscrupulous credit counseling and debt management firms. As consumer debt has increased, so has the number of credit counseling firms. An estimated 9 million Americans contact such firms annually, often after seeing ads on late-night cable television and so on. It goes into detail. The Commission's action comes as Congress is on the verge of enacting a new bankruptcy law that will require consumers to seek credit counseling before they file for bankruptcy. So on. We're concerned there are folks out there engaging in unscrupulous practices. If there are other companies out there that think they can deceive consumers, we've got three words for them: give it up. The FTC for a long time now has been investigating these things. You can't really get something for nothing. I think what goes wrong with most credit counseling firms across the United States, I've seen a lot of them. They tend to be controlled by creditors. Creditors sit on the board. Creditors run them. Creditors dictate policies and practices. In some ways, more or less run as a collection agency.
Mr. Finley, if I could interrupt just for a moment, I apologize, but because it sounds like some of your testimony is actually parallel with the proponent's testimony about the need for disclosure and fairness and making sure people are overcharged. I mean, you're talking about an industry as a whole. This bill specifically does those three things, and I'd like to have you address if you have any concerns. One, which is the point, everything else is current law. So the one major point, which is if the federal government requires work that would require that a fee could be charged if, in fact, this is done by federal or state action. The second point being that people have disclosure is required in advance of collecting fees. If you could comment on those, if you have any objections to those two provisions, because those are the ones that are the three provisions that we're looking at right now.
Okay, take the first one again. Give me that again, please.
Well, the first one is the debt consolidating agency demonstrates to the director the need for a fee for the credit counseling if it's required by rule or order by a federal or state agency. And our proponent was talking about the federal bankruptcy law, which may make that operable. And then the second point was that is to make sure that anyone who's going to get counseling signs in advance what the fees are going to be so they'll know, so they don't get into some of the situations that are in this Oregonian article you talked about.
Well, of course, when you're talking about the need for free counseling and things like that instigated by the bankruptcy court, you get deeply into the heart of a family. And I think that generally an individual counselor who sits down with that family and works with them directly on their individual problem, I think that's far more effective than what we're talking about here. The thing I object to is all of a sudden here are more charges than these so-called profit-making companies. And one thing I just dislike, which does hit right to your point, it says in there that that a company can't take its fee unless it pays directly to creditors. Well, that's a total disregard of the real conception of the whole thing. It says right now, in our law, the company's fee will not be payable until the company notifies or attempts to notify all creditors of client listed in the attached schedules of the terms for retiring the client's indebtedness. In other words, if you're sitting there counseling someone, as you often do, you might counsel them for weeks and never would be a charge. And if you wait until you mail the money to the creditor, you might wait for months. And how could you prove that the creditor received it? You're talking about a canceled check, which sometimes doesn't turn up for 60, 90 days. I think the person in debt demands and needs immediate help. I don't think it has to be predicated on any charge at all. I think that the part that's in the law now is perfectly good, and I see no reason to bring something into it which just makes it more complicated. If we're working with someone who's in debt, we might work with them for months, and yet we've never charged them anything. In this bill here, it says that you can't charge them anything until a creditor has deposited the check. Well, they take an awful lot of... I can see how that would cause more problems than it would really solve.
Mr. Penn, I'm going to hold you right there. Ms. Hamlin, if you want to come up, and if you could respond to the salient points that Mr. Finley has made, and we'll see if there's any questions, and we'll move on.
I have a lot of respect for Mr. Finley in the years that he's been in this business. However, I'm not quite tracking his comments about that you have to wait until the creditors deposit the money. I think that the way the statute was written is that you may not receive an amount from the client, take it as your fee, until the first installment of money has been sent to the creditors. So I'm not quite sure where he's getting this cashing the check. I'm not quite sure what he's interpreting there.
I don't see that in there anywhere. If you look at, you have a copy of our agreement. It's probably the last form that you have there. If you look at number five, it's reciting the law right there. It says the company's fee will not be payable until the company notifies or attempts to notify all creditors of the client listed in the attached schedules of the terms for retiring the client's indebtedness.
But I don't think there's anything in this bill that changes that, Mr. Finley.
Well, it says here that you have to mail him a check and prove he sent it to him, a check that you might not even have. Very often you'd enter the scene and he would give you the whole $25 to start. You're not connected any fee.
I don't see that, Mr. Finley, in the bill.
You're talking about this new bill?
That's what we're talking about, yes.
Yeah, but I'm talking about what goes on here. It appears to me, by looking at the bill, that you'd have to make a payment to a creditor before you could charge any fee of your own. Am I wrong there?
No, I think you're right, that you're saying that you have to mail the money to the creditors before you can take your own fee. And that's to try and keep these people that are holding the first month's deposit as a fee for themselves. Those that have been making millions and millions of dollars have typically done that by holding the first month's deposit as a fee for themselves. And this bill is saying you can't do that. You cannot take your fee until you've sent the money to the creditors.
Well, questions from the committee? Is there questions to the committee?
I just have
Senator Dicker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hamlin, one of the things that gentleman Mr. Finley mentioned was, do creditors control the nonprofit credit counseling services? Are they the funders of? If so, is that, I'm trying to think, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Boards of directors are very strange things. Within the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, only 40% of our board can be composed of credit grantors so that they don't have control over policy on the board. I have done some site visits for the Council of Accreditation to agencies that are not NFCC affiliated, and they're run almost 100% by family members of the employees who are not creditors. So, I mean, there's a wide range of things out there in the industry if, in fact, places do have a legitimate board of trustees. Are they controlled? Unfortunately, we are not able to dictate to creditors what they will take as repayments. That would be a Chapter 13. We do not have the power of a Chapter 13. So we know what the guidelines are that the creditors will accept for a payment. If you owe them $1,000, they'll take a payment of $25 a month. They will tell you that that's what you're going to be sending them as a minimum. So in that way, they control the industry in that we know what their guidelines are for what they'll accept. Otherwise, they have the option of saying, we're not going to accept this. We'll continue to charge the high interest rates, and we'll take the late fees and the over-limit fees they were entitled to take. So if you send them a dollar amount that they will agree to, which unfortunately is an extremely low amount and can almost result in reverse amortization or negative amortization for some of these families, sometimes they'll take a fee that's less than the interest they're charging. That's not productive for families, and I won't let that happen in my agency. So do they control it? In a way, it's partly their game, because the only other alternative is bankruptcy for families.
Any other questions? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 327. We'll address that later. Thank you both. I'm going to go back to the top of the order. We're on a work session on Senate Bill 413. Colleagues, this is the very fascinating bill we heard a month or so ago about Central Oregon Cooperative, and at that time I wasn't sure about whether we were going to do anything with the bill. It seemed like kind of a dispute, but I asked the Public Utility Commission to do us give us an evaluation of the public policy issue. There's a copy of Chairman Byers' response to us on this issue, and just for the record, I will read his concluding remarks, because this is a cooperative and therefore not under PUC jurisdiction. But he said, while this case isn't a PUC issue, I do think it rises to the level of public policy the legislature should consider. If electricity is indeed a necessity, and it is, what authority should a utility have to make the service available? Are the rights of a few in protecting their land more important than assuring reliable electricity to the greater public? If not the utility, who should decide the technical issue of whether transmission lines are necessary and where they should be located? And there's an Attorney General more extensive packet to be made available to you. But I think this issue is one that should move forward through this process and continue that debate. We had a very lively hearing on that, on those issues, and it was indeed fascinating. So I think first thing I would like to do is entertain a motion to move this to the floor.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Starr.
Can we have a dash one amendment?
Yes, yes. Thank you very much, Senator.
Can we have an explanation of that?
Yes. Teresa.
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members. The dash one amendments are provided by on behalf of the Central Electric Co-op, which is the proponent of the bill. It clarifies the intent of the bill. It expands the provision in which a county cannot place conditions upon the continuation or alteration in the case of an electric utility transmission line to ensure safe operation or to provide additional capacity to meet growing demand. And it also modifies the language regarding the definition of an alteration of a nonconforming use to include electric transmission lines. A change results in the transmission line and the physical structures and improvements, such as the taller utility poles that the co-op would like to use.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Senator Starr.
Move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 413.
Senator Starr has moved the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 413. Discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 413 as amended to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 413 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Thank you. It's frustrating, quite frankly, when we have issues like this come before us, ones that ought to be worked out between two parties.
Yes.
And so it puts legislators, puts us in a very, I think, difficult position of, you know, kind of picking the winners or the losers. But as we heard this bill and the issues that surrounded this bill, I quite frankly agree with the statement that Chairman Byer made in his email, that we're talking about providing electricity to folks that need electricity and allowing a utility to plan and plan for that additional capacity that's needed for them to supply to their constituents, their customers. And for that reason, I'm going to support this bill, even though it's a little bit of an uneasy support, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and hopefully those parties will see that together and continue to work themselves as we move this bill through the process. Any other comments? Any objection? So ordered. I have a funny feeling I will be carrying the bill. Let's open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1017. Ask Jim Denham and Senator Morris, might want to introduce him, but and Jim Denham from Wauchang and Ed Pinkley. This is Frank Morris Day at the Capitol. Welcome again, Senator.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and colleagues. For the record, Frank Morris, State Senator, District 8. I'd like to thank you for scheduling this bill. This is a very, very difficult issue to bring forward, which essentially is a conflict between two very, very fine companies in our state, Northwest Natural Gas and Wauchang, that is a manufacturer, major employer in of metals in Linn County. What I would like to do is to have first have Jim Denham, corporate counsel for Wauchang, set the case statement here, and then have Mr. Pinkley follow up with respect to the broader issues that are also surrounding this.
Thank you.
But I thank you very much for holding this hearing.
Welcome, Mr. Denham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jim Denham. I'm the General Counsel and Public Affairs Coordinator for Wauchang. We're an Allegheny Technologies Incorporated affiliate, and we're a manufacturer of specialty metals and chemicals in Albany. I appear before you today on a matter of great importance to the continued economic viability of my company and its 975 employees, as well as to the ability of the state of Oregon to retain and attract manufacturing business to this state. That matter is Senate Bill 1017, which is designed to clarify the rights of large industrial gas users to purchase gas directly from wholesale suppliers through a direct connection to an interstate gas pipeline, rather than purchase it from a regulated utility. Such a direct connection can be very important for an industrial customer to compete in the global marketplace, since it can significantly reduce the energy cost paid by that entity. The trade-off is that the entity installing the connection must manage it and maintain it, take responsibility for contracting for its own gas on the wholesale market, and comply with all the regulatory and safety requirements established for such facilities. As a result, only a very small number of companies, approximately six, have established such direct connections since they were approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in 1988. The legality of these direct connections is not in question. What is the question and the issue of Senate Bill 1017 to address is the ability of more than one company to jointly own such a direct connection to an interstate pipeline. Now, we're not talking about a situation where one company with a direct connection decides to sell gas to its neighbor. We're talking about an arrangement where two or more companies would jointly own the direct connection piping and facilities. Each owner would be responsible for contracting with the wholesale suppliers for their own gas. Each owner would be responsible for maintaining the direct connection facilities, and each would be responsible for complying with all regulatory and safety requirements. Interestingly, one such connection already exists in this state with the full sanction and approval of the Public Utility Commission and the utility involved. And several special contracts have been written with PUC approval to supply gas at special contract rates to customers who have been able to show the ability to build such a jointly owned direct connection as a competitive alternative. In spite of this long history of past approval of such arrangements, when my company agreed with Weyerhaeuser in 2000 to jointly own and operate a direct connection to provide both of our companies with natural gas, our right to do so under Oregon's territorial allocation statute was challenged by Northwest Natural Gas in a declaratory ruling proceeding. Litigation has now been underway for 5 years and has gone all the way to the Court of Appeals. The Public Utility Commission has twice agreed that such connections are allowed under our current statute, and a circuit court judge has agreed with the Commission's position on this. The Court of Appeals recently has taken issue with the reasoning used in these cases and has remanded the matter back to the PUC for further action. Our goal in introducing Senate Bill 1017 is to clarify for the courts and the Public Utility Commission what we have all believed the law to be and end this protracted court battle. Please keep in mind, as you consider this issue, that we are not aware of any state in the nation that prohibits jointly owned direct connections such as those allowed by this bill. If we truly are, as a state, open for business and want to encourage existing businesses to expand and new businesses to locate here, we must not put ourselves at such a competitive disadvantage. You will hear from others that this bill will open a Pandora's box of daisy chain direct connections and cost regulated utilities millions of dollars in revenues. We do not believe this concern is supported by the facts. Circumstances under which direct connections make good economic sense are very rare and are controlled by the size of a company's gas load, their sophistication as a consumer of gas, and their proximity, usually no more than a very few miles, to an interstate pipeline. That is why so few exist today, even though they have been allowed since the 1980s. We are working actively with the Public Utilities Commission to find language for this bill that is acceptable to them. This process is ongoing. We are happy to work with any party who has a sincere desire to find a reasonable solution to this problem, and, in fact, just this week, we entered into discussions with Northwest Natural Gas aimed at resolving the issue, at least for Wacheng. I'm hopeful that these discussions will bring a resolution to our concern. I would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much, Mr. Denham. What I think I'll do is we'll go to Mr. Finkley next, and then we'll open him for questions.
Right.
One thing I would advise, we do have your testimony before us, and I already read through it, and see a lot of the first part of it is the historical perspective we have received. So if you can kind of pick it up from there rather than repeat, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Ed Finkley, and I am an attorney with Cable Houston in Portland, and I am counsel for the Northwest Industrial Gas Users. And I appear before you today in support of Senate Bill 1017. As I stated in my written testimony, the Industrial Gas Users are a trade association of about 32 companies in Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, about 15 of which are here in the state of Oregon, and Wacheng is one of our members. And I do detail some of the background on the fact that today industrial customers have the right to transport their own natural gas. 20 years ago, that wasn't true. Our organization was the organization that started the fight over whether industrial customers should be able to transport their own gas, at least in this region. Those laws have been clear now since about the 1980s. From 1988 through today, as Mr. Denham notes, there are approximately six customers that have built their own pipelines to directly connect their industrial plants with the two interstate pipelines that bring natural gas from Canada or the Wyoming-Utah area into our state. And in two situations, two customers own the piping together, and that's the reason that we're here today. Under current law, this legislature has granted the three Oregon natural gas local distribution companies exclusive service territories. In those territories, only the company that can engage in the business of distributing natural gas. The reasons are two: efficiencies and safety. The Oregon legislature decided decades ago that we don't want multiple gas pipelines serving the same area. Competition doesn't work because the business of distributing natural gas is thought to be a natural monopoly. So the legislature has granted companies private monopolies to deliver gas in the towns and the cities that they serve. The granting of that monopoly, however, was never intended to keep customers from serving themselves. The Northwest Industrial Gas Users support Senate Bill 1017 in order to clarify that under current Oregon law, this legislature has not prohibited natural gas customers from owning their own pipeline if it is more efficient than having Northwest Natural provide that service under the grant of its monopoly. I think Mr. Denham described already the administrative procedure that's been ongoing. I do want to note that there's nothing in Senate Bill 1017 that is an effort to overturn any previous rulings of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. The intent of the bill is to clarify that if six or fewer entities own a gas piping facility that directly connect their facilities that burn natural gas to the interstate pipeline, that their ownership and operation of those facilities does not violate the local distributor's exclusive service territory, no matter how the gas piping system would be configured. If enacted, the bill will clarify that the language in the first sentence of 758-403 does not prohibit six or fewer entities from jointly owning their own piping systems. We believe that the bill is good economic and energy policy for Oregon, as well as being good law. If the bill is enacted, it will keep Oregon's utility laws consistent with regulation in other states. We have thoroughly researched this, and we can find no state in the United States that has ever interpreted its exclusive service territory statutes as prohibiting two or more entities from jointly owning a direct connection to an interstate pipeline. And we know such arrangements are operating today lawfully and without challenge in the state of Washington and in the state of California. So on both to the north and the south of us, this is clearly legal. Without the clarification provided by Senate Bill 1017, Oregon risks having an obstacle to attracting large manufacturers that will provide family wage jobs for our citizens in the future. We believe that holding down energy costs is a critical component to our manufacturers being competitive in the future, and higher wages for tomorrow's Oregonians are tied in part, in our opinion, to lower energy costs in this state. The ability and the opportunity to directly connect to an interstate pipeline, as Mr. Denham has noted, is driven by the size of the natural gas usage and the proximity of the company to the pipeline, as well as its sophistication in managing its own energy needs. Thus, the right will be rarely exercised, but it should be clearly preserved. We urge the committee to adopt this bill. We think that it will clarify the existing law, and in every case that I'm aware of where either one or two companies have directly connected, it's only happened after there have been extensive negotiations with the local distributor involved, and only after the customer or customers have determined that it's really critical to their long-term economic future that they do that. We do note in our written testimony that there is even a situation in the state of Oregon. It's not subject to Oregon Commission regulation because it crosses the Columbia River, but Northwest Natural and Portland General Electric jointly built a direct connection to the interstate pipeline in Kelso, Washington, across the Columbia River to serve the Beaver plant to hold down the price of electricity for Portland General's customers. So even Northwest Natural has been involved in essentially the same type of operations when it's the most efficient. And that's all that we ever have stood for or ever will, is that we believe that owning your own facilities is not a form of competition that the legislature ever intended to protect utilities from, and that in the situations where this is the most efficient way to deliver the gas, that it should be clear in Oregon law that it's lawful to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Finklia. Again, we're having these interesting wars between parties. And any questions from Senator Decker? Do you have any questions at the moment?
I do.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wrote three things down and would be happy. I'll get them one at a time and be happy to hear mostly the attorney's response because they're legal in nature.
They're more legal.
Please jump in if I don't see excitement on your behalf to do that. Just on the litigation, we are usually reticent to get into a case that is pending. So where you said it's been 5 years, that this case has been litigated, where are you at, and has a decision been rendered, and is it on appeals right now, or where are we at with the litigation?
There's been a Court of Appeals decision that has remanded the case back to the Public Utility Commission for further hearings and findings consistent with that opinion, and we're right at the beginning stages of doing those rehearings.
So I guess the natural outflow, Mr. Chair, of that question is why would the legislature involve itself on a case that is being handled by the PUC in the Court of Appeals, and I assume satisfactorily to your point of view, but don't know.
It's impossible for me to tell whether or not the Court of Appeals decision is going to end up being acceptable to our point of view. The reason that we would ask you to address this is that the entire subject matter of the case is interpretation of what some believe is ambiguous territorial allocation law. Well, that territorial allocation law was passed by this body. And so it seems to me that the legislation does not need to be litigated if the intent of the statute is clear, and we just want to make sure that the intent of the statute is clear, and then everybody will know what the law is.
Yes, go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other things I wrote down, and this might be an easy one on safety issues, if enacted, and maybe we'll use Washington and California as a guide, would you have to follow all of the same if you were doing six as opposed to two or none? Would all of the safety requirements that the PUC regulates and you both want to go, so
sure. I actually addressed it in my written testimony, and I apologize for skipping over that in my oral remarks. All the safety regulations for the transportation of natural gas apply whether the facilities are owned by a local distributor or owned by a private party. The safety regulations are the same. You cannot tell the difference. The Watchang and Weyerhaeuser have to comply with all the same safety requirements that Northwest Natural would have to comply with, or Cascade Natural, or Avista.
In anticipation of this question, I actually brought Watchang's energy manager, Eric Larson, who is charged with responsibility for making sure we comply with all those regulations, in case you wanted to ask him any questions about how that works.
I'll take your word for it. Then the natural question is just cost shifting. I guess, how do you respond to the other customers, in this case of Northwest Natural, that would be affected if, and I know this is being litigated, but if it was in fact six, I guess what is the response to the remaining customers of the utility?
Go ahead. Our organization, as I said in my prepared remarks, has appeared before the Utility Commission since 1984, and one of the things we have consistently argued for is cost-based rates. If rates are based on the cost of service, it will be very rare that a customer will take on these kind of responsibilities rather than the gas company providing the service itself. That's part of why I think today the state has far less risk than it did 20 years ago. Over the past 20 years, really a landmark decision was made by the Oregon Commission just in 2003 to really bring Northwest Natural's transportation rates in line with the cost of providing the service. There will probably be in the future still some situations where two or more customers may find that, given their proximity to the pipeline, that the most efficient thing to do is to own their own line. Does that, the term we used in the electric industry is, does that strand costs that therefore other customers have to pick up? In our opinion, the answer to that is no, and this is why. In the situations where existing customers have directly connected to an interstate pipeline, the facilities that were used to provide the service prior to the direct connection have generally been in the ground for many years. In some cases, were fully depreciated, but for some reason there was an economic mismatch between what Northwest Natural wanted to charge for the service and what the customer thought it could do by providing its own service. So in those couple of situations, you've had customers do this on their own. Are there... Is there $28 on the utilities books that you could find on that old pipe that isn't depreciated at the time that the utility lost its customer? It's always possible that that could happen, and it could be $28,000. There's two answers that industrial customers have to those situations. One is, if we go out of business, then there's always stranded costs. And there's not only stranded costs, there's stranded employees. And the manufacturers in your region today are fighting so hard to try to keep alive that the little bit of so-called stranded costs that the utilities might tout before you as a reason to say, no, let's keep this law all ambiguous, is just not enough to justify telling the industrial customers of your state today and the future industries that may come here to provide jobs tomorrow that this is one state where you can't do what you can do in the other 49.
Thank you.
Yeah. Any other questions for this group?
No, thank you.
I'll let you step down for a moment. Do we have anybody from the PUC here today? Yes, could you come over for a moment before we go to the next testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Committee. My name is Bonnie Tatum. I'm representing the Public Utility Commission this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Bonnie, for coming. I think we just had a couple questions. You heard the first testimony from the proponents on this bill, and it's been described as a clarification of the law, and I would be interested in your interpretation, how the PUC interprets that law. I mean, is that a correct interpretation of what this bill does, is clarify the law, or any enlightenment on that would be helpful for us?
I'm not sure that clarify is the word that we would use. It certainly changes the law to add additional circumstances for which a connection or a something is not considered utility service. It creates another exception to a provision of utility service.
Okay. The proponents have talked about that in the other 49 states, the provisions of this bill are already understood as standard policy. Is that your interpretation?
I do not know that to be a fact, sir.
Okay. Question, Senator Starr.
Thank you. Has the PUC taken position on Senate Bill 1017?
Yes, on Tuesday they had a meeting and they opposed Senate Bill 1017.
And do you have, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please.
Do you have some written rationale or explanation for why the PUC opposes it that you could provide this committee?
Yes, I do.
That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Any other questions? Senator Decker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm just kind of following up. Was the vote 3-0?
Yes.
It was a unanimous vote. And you're going to provide us a written rationale, but...
I have some bullet comments I could make. Okay. I didn't expect to testify today, so I don't
know.
No,
you're doing very well.
Thank you. The commission does oppose Senate Bill 1017. They believe that there is a rate impact on customers. I think that is your question, Senator Deckard, that has not been clearly identified. The exposure on other customers that this bill creates may not be effectively mitigated, even with language changes that might limit participation. And for the few customers that the requesters believe would associate to jointly own their own facilities, we think that special contracts may still be a viable alternative. Special contracts that the commission approves between the an LDC, a local distribution company, and the industrial customer.
And Mr. Chair,
yes.
Have you ever had application for a special contract that would allow these?
My understanding is that there are two such currently in place. And Mr. Finkley probably could provide specific information on those. They occurred before my time.
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Jenks and Mr. Bauer, if you could come forward. Thank you. welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members and senators of the committee, my name is Bob Jenks, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board. We're a statewide advocate for residential customers of utilities. We oppose this bill. We believe what this bill does is create economic inefficiency. The basic purpose of the territorial allocation law and rules is to prevent duplication of distribution services. This duplication of those distribution facilities raises the overall cost of providing utility service. That's the explicit goal of those statutes. When an industrial customer abandons its facilities, it's an increased cost to the remaining customers on that system who will be asked to pay for those facilities. It also will reduce the rate of return for the utility who, under the current law as it's been interpreted by the courts, is not allowed to earn a rate of return on abandoned plant. So there's a cost both to customers and to utilities. On the electric side, we call this stranded costs in Senate Bill 1149, the electric restructuring law. CUB supported it, and we supported giving industrial customers access, direct access to buying their own electricity without going through the utility, but we did it with the explicit deal that they would cover their stranded costs as part of that the stranded costs wouldn't be shifted onto other customers. That's what's missing from this law. CUB agrees that that this could also harm economic development. It's interesting. A few years ago, there was the issue of providing gas service to Coos Bay. That went through this legislature. The Coos Bay citizens voted to put up money for that, and then it went to the PUC. And CUB was involved in the rate case over the issue of service to Coos Bay. Our belief was the primary purpose of that was economic development. The primary beneficiary of the Coos Bay pipeline and distribution service would be industrial customers there. We were a little skeptical of some of the load projections and other things, but in the end, we were able to sit down, roll up our sleeves, work with the gas company, work with the Coos Bay officials, and come up with a settlement that allowed gas service to go to Coos Bay and gas and a distribution line be built to serve the industrial customers of Coos County. Under this bill, we would be much more reluctant to engage in those kinds of negotiations because you put us in a position where if Northwest Natural goes out and builds those distribution facilities for those customers, they may well be abandoned and we're the deep pocket that ultimately would have to pick up those costs if they get abandoned. And again, we don't think that's good economics. We would prefer to pay the cost of our service but not pay the cost of somebody else's service. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jenks. I think let's go to Mr. Bauer. And then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. I appreciate the opportunity to appear this afternoon. And as I start my comments, I would like to just echo what Mr. Denham stated is that as a result of some conversations with Senator Morris, we have had some discussions with Wachang. We are trying to resolve the issue. We think we can do that. And so we're hopeful that maybe this legislation just can go away and that will solve the issue for those most of us. Although I will tell you, I think Mr. Finkley probably has additional clients that would like to see the issue continue. Most of the comments I was going to make are in my written testimony, and other people have made those. So let me just kind of maybe try to respond to various comments that others have made. First of all, most of these customers are already contracting for their gas from a supply field, maybe in the Rockies or up in Canada. They use the interstate pipeline system to transport their gas. And then for us, they're what we call transport customers. They basically pay us a fee to move the gas through our pipelines. And so it's not keeping these people from going out and finding a supply source and buying the gas as economically as they can. But it does deal with the fact that it does cost to move that gas through our system. There was a question about cost shifts that Senator Deckard had, and Mr. Finkley talked about cost-based rates. In our last rate case, we are trying to move the industrial customers and all of the classes into a cost-based mechanism. And hopefully that will assist these large customers who are in a situation to be able to do that and bring their costs down to what it actually costs to move it through. For years, a lot of rate making had some social engineering to it, basically. And industrial customers did pay a price in part to to support residential customers or other maybe small commercial customers. I think what you're seeing today is definitely a shift so that the classes pay basically what it does cost to serve them. The other thing, I guess a couple things I'd like to mention is that we've done some calculations. If you take the legislation as written, we believe it would basically run about $18 to $20 million of lost revenue, and that's on a margin that we currently get industrial load of about $40 million. So if you were to try to just keep those costs within the industrial class, probably wouldn't happen. I mean, that's a pretty large impact on the industrial sector. Then, as a result, there'd be, and based on cost-based rates, you would look at spreading this cost across to others. And the reason for spreading it is these are facilities that are there that you've put in to serve your customers. And that's, I think, what Mr. Jenks mentioned, is that then these costs get spread to other customers. And it could be maybe a 3 or 4 cents per therm, which is about a 3 to 4% increase for industrial or for commercial and residential customers. So we think there is an issue there. The concept of special contracts, we believe, is still a good way to go. It allows us to sit down and negotiate with an individual customer. And in doing so, what you try to find is the right level of rates in that special circumstance. So for the customer that is sitting next to that interstate transmission line, what does it take to keep that person on our system, but yet give them, and so they've got enough of an incentive to stay there and not go out and build their own pipeline. Now, if you just open that up, the flip side is you will now have customers that are not near a pipeline system who basically will not benefit at all from this legislation. And so I think, again, you need to kind of realize that we've got industrial customers, depending on their location, can be impacted differently by this. But again, if we can resolve the issue, that is our goal, is to do it, and to do it through a special contract. Special contracts are approved by the Public Utility Commission. Two other quick things, maybe just touching on Senator Deckard's questions. In terms of the litigation, comments were correct. It has been remanded back to Public Utility Commission. However, Mr. Finkley, I know, did ask the Public Utility Commission to delay taking any additional action while they go back to court and argue some additional issues. I don't know what the status is. I don't know if the Commission has decided to act on that or not. And in terms of safety, yes, I believe they are subject to all of the other regulations. I do not know whether or not they will have direct oversight from the Public Utility Commission, which we have. I do know that our customers end up paying for that level of regulation. I don't know who pays for it for the industrial customers. And again, I just close with we think in the end that society benefits under the current territory allocation statutes, which are designed to eliminate duplication and to try to basically balance the cost between all the customer classes as well as with the company. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bauer. Yeah, that's a very interesting situation there, because like I say, if you have access to these pipelines, it would be less for you, but then your fellow industrial customers who don't have that access would see theirs likely go up, and I'm just talking about the industrial ones, but certainly residential as well, but there's that trade-off. So that's very interesting. Questions for the committee? Yes, Senator Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just one, and the most powerful part of the testimony that the prior panel had was, and whenever we hear 49 other states, that is usually a pretty powerful statement. Have this provision for their manufacturers, and I don't know if you care to respond, but I jotted it down and noted it. Would Oregon be an outlier on this issue? Put that to Mr. Bauer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, I've not done that research, but I'd be happy to go back to our national association and see if I can find out for you.
Thank you.
Mr. Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The powerful testimony that I heard was talked about companies that employ hundreds of people going out of business because they can't afford to stay in business because of the high energy rates and other costs, and this is a way for them to control their costs. It doesn't benefit Northwest Natural if these customers go out of business either. I would think that it would be in Northwest Natural's favor to find a way to work with these companies, one, to keep them as customers, keep them as employing Oregonians in their businesses.
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, agree with you. We're only as healthy as the economy of the state is. I mean, we are here and we serve basically our customers, and our customers, if they go out of business or if they have problems paying their bills, we're directly impacted by that. Again, that's why we try to use a special contract and try to work out an arrangement that will benefit all parties. And they are subject to the Public Utility Commission, so the PUC does have the opportunity to come in and say, no, it looks like you've gone too far one way or too far another way or whatever. But and so maybe the downside of that is everybody just has come to the table in the end. CUB is able to participate in these discussions as well. What we try to do is find a solution that addresses everybody's needs.
Thank you. I would echo what Senator Starr has said. This is another issue where we're trying to balance things, and we have gone the path of litigation. And I think what we'll do on this, as this Senator Deckard pointed out, we're reticent to get involved in this unless we think there's a big public policy. What we, I think, will do over the next few days is. Kind of chew on the information we have from this hearing and see what that public policy is. And in the meantime, hope that you folks, considering both the values of the users as a whole as well as this individual user, see if some progress can be made that you could report back to us and solve that first on your own. And if not, then we'll see what we might do. So thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1017. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 55. And Teresa, do you want to just give us a short summary of Senate Bill 55?
Yes. Mr. Chair, committee members, you have in front of you some Dash 2 amendments which replaces the bill. The amendments on the bill are based upon a task force that's been working on Essentially, emerging industries that are regulated under the Oregon State Board of Examiners of Engineering and Land Surveying, otherwise known as OSBILs. Part of what it does, it defines the minimum qualifications for the practice of photogrammetry, otherwise known as GIS practitioners, and also does a scope of other things dealing with emerging industries.
Thank you. We have Mr. Dan Lynching and Dean Anderson and a host of supporters. So we're going to ask Dan and Dean to come up and speak for our page of supporters, but note that we have a number of members of the board and the profession that are in the audience here today, so if we need additional expertise, we have plenty. And we are expecting, and by the way... Oh, and Tom. And Mr. Gallagher, who introduced them. And one thing the committee, I want you to know in advance, and I'm sorry I forgot to mention this before the hearing, that we are expecting a map that demonstrates the location of the state capitol so that we can have that and make sure we can always find it and
oh, good.
Have that checked.
Very
welcome.
Thoughtful.
Thank you, Chair, Senators. Dan Lynchide with Yamhill County, the county surveyor. I'm not going to go over the written testimony that's being handed to you. I just want to briefly touch on a few high points. In the 01 session, House Bill 3944 was introduced, and PLSO supported that bill. And there was a lot of opposition came down from state agencies and from the GIS folks and the photogrammetry people, and we were told to go out in the hall and straighten it out. And since that fall, we started our first meeting of this task force, and about that same time, the National Council on Examiners for Engineers and Land Surveyors started a process of model law and model rule for addressing this very same situation. And, gosh, as everybody knows, for about a $100 bill, you can buy a little handheld GPS unit that will get you to accuracy of about 20 feet. And what we saw happening at the state board level was complaints coming in that would say that perhaps a city over on the coast, for example, would want to go out for an RFP that would say, we want to have someone come in and locate all our manholes and all our hydrants, and we want that done as cheap as possible, of course. And so they would do that, but it would be a surveyor out there who is that would have loved to step in and said, here's exactly where these are. But what was happening was the complaint would come down that it was a non-surveyor doing this, and that non-surveyor was saying that this position that I'm returning to you in this report for that manhole cover is very accurate. So that, when the board received those complaints, we had to make a call. Is the public being harmed here by this? That's what we were kind of looking at and trying to balance that. The old laws that we're working under currently GIS and GPS weren't even dreamt of when we were doing when these laws were conceived, and that's what we're laboring under right now at the board level. So those complaints, for the most part, went away, and we worked them out with the people. And one of the things that you'll see on page 9, lines 3 and 13, you'll see that there are some exceptions. People who would not be impacted by this, basically the GIS folks, the photogrammetrists, of course, they're built into the law. But then foresters, geologists, and others needing to collect and map or display this type of data for their professions are exempted. So with that, and folding in the photogrammetrists who are also here in force today to support this bill, I think that if I have any questions from you, I'd certainly be happy to answer them.
Okay. Why don't we go to our next guest, and then we'll see.
Chairman Metzger, members of the committee, for my group, my name is Dean Anderson. I'm the IT director for Polk County, and I'm a private GIS consultant. Just real briefly, I've been a GIS professional in private state local government for about 25 years. The laws that exist today were written a while back. They are not consistent with current technology and capabilities. This current legislation updates the definition of surveying, clarifies the mechanisms for photogrammetrists to be licensed, clearly defines when GIS, planning, cartography, natural resources are not surveying, as Dan had mentioned, provides a mechanism so OSBILS, so if new technology comes on board so that OSBILS can identify those exemptions in the future, it's consistent with national definitions. It's based on the new updated survey model law and rules adopted by the National Council of Examiners in Engineering and Surveying. The task force that I chaired, I was given our first email, had a meeting earlier today. Our first meeting of this task force was October 1st, 2001. We've worked together for a while to make this happen. Professional organizations that have participated are the OASIS, the County Surveyors of Oregon, Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon, Oregon GIS Association, which is local government GIS professionals, the Oregon Geographic Information Council, OGIC, URESA, which is the Oregon Regional Information Systems Association, County Cartographers, and OSBILS, as well as the Association of Photogrammetrists, Remote Sensing, and ASPRS.
Can you read those all again really fast?
Well, you know, I'm dyslexic, too. So it,
and then, if you could, I have it in written form, but for the record, because you were instructed to go back and put all the parties together to develop this, if you could just articulate for the record the different organizations that helped put this bill together and who have signed on to this piece of legislation.
Mr. Chair, it is the OASIS, which is the Oregon, the County Surveyors, Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon, Local Government GIS Professionals, OGISA, the Oregon Geographic Information Council, OGIC, which is the state agencies that deal with GIS, the GIS Professionals, which is URISA, the County Cartographers that work with Department of Revenue, and OSBILS, and then the Association of Photogrammetrists and Remote Sensing, the photogrammetrists.
And how long did it take you to come up with this? I'm just curious, with all those folks there, with all those acronyms.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. The issue wasn't all of those folks. It was that we were pretty far apart 4 years ago.
Yeah.
It was not a happy time.
Yeah. Well, it's always good when people get together and solve those issues. It's interesting when as technology does change, and to be able to keep up with that technology. Some people get caught in the loop because the law doesn't match the technology. And I really appreciate your efforts in clarifying that and recognizing the value of those tools, but also keeping people out of the legal web because we haven't updated the law. Questions? Any questions, Senator Starr? Thank you very much. I have no one signed up in opposition, but I will ask in case somebody just decides they want to do that. All right, we're going to close the public hearing. We'll come back to this bill and Senator Deckard returns, but we're going to close the public hearing, Senate Bill 55. And let's see. We're supposed to be 955. Okay, we're going to open up public hearing on Senate Bill 955. Now, I have four individuals testifying. Everyone who has signed up on 555 are in support. Bob Ball, John Carroll, Sally Weston, and Ed, looks like Ed Earl. If you're all from different groups, that's all come up. If you guys are singing the same song, it would be better just to have a couple of you do that, and then the rest of you for expertise. Welcome. Welcome. Hi, anybody want to start?
Yes. Thank you, Chairman Metzger and committee members. My name is Robert Ball, and I'm here today because a crisis is beginning to form in the Oregon condominium housing industry, of which I am a part. We hope to avoid what has previously occurred in California as new and similar problems begin to emerge in Oregon. In California, building slowed to a crawl in our industry. Good developers and contractors left the business. And even today, I can tell you from firsthand experience, having actually gone down and looked at the product on many occasions, a lot of the product being built in California just doesn't measure up. In fact, they're coming to Oregon to learn from us. The amendments to Senate Bill 955 create a number of changes to the bill and current law to address the problems of rising insurance costs, expensive litigation, good contractors and developer teams leaving the business, and low levels of maintenance by condominium homeowners associations. The bill, as amended, would allow developer teams to offer a 3-year warranty rather than the currently required 1-year warranty. It reduces the statute of ultimate repose for construction defects from 10 years to 4 on condominiums only. And it requires that developer teams provide maintenance plans that are easily accessible and easy to follow for condominium homeowners associations. Under Senate Bill 955, a homeowners association would be required to follow the maintenance plan or an alternative plan, but limits the liability for problems that occur if a maintenance plan is not followed. It is a reasonable balance of responsibility between the development team and new owners. Our economy will be significantly damaged if condominium housing is forced to a slow crawl due to these emerging problems. Imagine if we would have taken housing out of Oregon's economy over the last decade. Condominium development in Portland alone over the last few years and those on the foreseeable horizon will amount to over $1 billion. This will mean thousands and thousands of jobs, local suppliers and manufacturers selling millions of dollars of goods, and Oregonians having a quality and varied selection of housing opportunities. Lawsuits or unreasonably expensive processes can now be counted on regardless of the quality of any project. This has caused insurance rates to increase at such a rapid rate that projects are starting to become unfeasible and all the experienced team members who build them are leaving the business. As an example, a 132-unit project in 1999 cost $83,000 to insure. Today, a 226-unit project by the same developer, not quite twice the size, cost around $1,775,000 or $7,800 per unit to insure. Even more shocking is an example which you'll hear about more today, which is a 50-unit condominium costing $1,048,000, over $20,000 a unit to insure. A normal insurance cost is now between 7% and 10% of the construction budget. How can we solve this emerging crisis? First, we need to ensure experienced teams are building quality buildings and construction defects are identified and fixed by those teams. Second, we need to ensure that homeowners are properly educated as to how to maintain large buildings and then have to look for a way to check that it's being done. This bill will help us achieve those goals. We want to emphasize that no one is trying to run away from any responsibility. Developers will be able to offer a 3-year warranty instead of 1 year. Real construction defects can easily be identified in this time period, and developer teams will be responsible for fixing them. However, the requirement to have developers provide a blueprint for proper maintenance will help. This lack of maintenance is the major source of other long-term issues that are causing the greatest problems for homeowners associations. Recently, a contractor that I have personally worked with turned down a $100 million condominium project because they just didn't want the exposure of a possible lawsuit hanging over them for 10 years, knowing that most associations aren't properly maintaining the buildings. Architects I know have also turned down jobs when they readily accepted them just a few years ago. Making sure construction defects are addressed in the first few years, providing homeowners with the tools they will need to properly maintain their buildings, and creating a reasonable balance of responsibility will dramatically change insurance rates. This bill will ensure we stay on a healthy and progressive path in the tradition that Oregon is known for. We've always been ahead of the curve, and we do things that just can't get done in other states. This bill is a shining example of that and will show us as an industry leader once again. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ball. Well, I'll have you know, since you haven't had the opportunity to sit with us for the last couple of months, we've been hearing a lot of similar stories in the entire construction industry, so about insurance and the length of warranties, et cetera. So it's an industry-wide issue and beyond just yours. Appreciate you bringing this forward. Who would like to be next?
If I might, my name is John Carroll. Chairman Metzger, Senators, appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation with you. Clearly, when you look at the existing laws and statutes that are in place, there are mechanisms that provide for maintenance manuals, turnover documents that effectively are intended to be an educational tool, but the harsh reality is that the homeowners associations, the unit owners, they look at the stack of papers and they sometimes are confused. How do we execute through these maintenance programs? One of our primary objectives is to put together a maintenance and operations manual for the building that is used as a basis for the reserve study, which is a requirement through the state, an annual reserve study. This accomplishes two things. One, it suggests that there is a plan that people can follow so that the roof does get repaired, the windows do get repaired if they have problems. If we have an earthquake, it provides for an inspection protocol that ensures that the building isn't headed in a particular direction. The other thing is that it does properly identify the maintenance protocol and a budget to ensure that the maintenance gets performed. One of the real shocks to people living in condominiums is when they go in and their maintenance is $50 a month, and then it triples once they figure out what it really costs to maintain a facility. The quick comparison is that a project that we've been involved with was 348,000 square feet, a downtown office building of 350,000 feet has three or four full-time people providing maintenance and operations support for the building, and yet a condominium, which has 150 to 200 owners, is not getting the same attention. And we strongly suggest that there's a real win-win objective for all the participants if there is a requirement to have a maintenance manual in place and the reserves are properly identified so it is not a surprise. One quick personal story. On the way down here this morning, I got a call from my son who lives in California, and he said he's moving back to Oregon for a lot of reasons, one of which is quality of life, but he's just moving out of a condominium in Los Angeles, and it has been a nightmare for him. This is a very important step for us. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. Welcome.
Good afternoon. I'm Sally Weston. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. I am not quite singing the same song these men are singing because I am one of the investors that Gene Tate talks about in the letter you have before you. And not only am I and my husband an investor, but we are looking very eagerly forward to living in the downtown Tate. It's going to be called the Tate in downtown Eugene. And we see this building as a landmark for Eugene, and we have been working diligently, 11 of us, on this project for 2 years, and we have yet to break ground. And we have come across stumbling blocks a couple of times that have nearly crashed our project utterly, and it has had to do with insurance. The insurance started out being so astronomically expensive that we thought we were going to have to quit. Well, then we went to Portland developer and thought we were going to have some insurance for less because they had a longer track record of developing condominiums. But in fact, we're back to in excess of $1 million, which is a whole lot of money for insurance just for the construction process. This proposed legislation would give an alternative, and I think the manual you've been hearing about would be extremely useful. I'm an owner of a rental in a different condominium in downtown Eugene, and it's been a big serious problem buying insurance. Insurance companies don't want to insure condominiums, so something has to be done. My view is that condominiums are a vital tool in keeping downtowns vital in cities in Oregon as around the country. It brings people downtown in compact urban growth. It frees up the home they've been living, in our case 35 years in eastern Eugene up in the hills, and for a family whose children are still at home. It gets us downtown shopping, walking. That's my whole goal, is to go down where I can walk to accomplish everything, and to revitalize and bring some life to downtown Eugene. If it can't happen, if with the best of intentions, not to make money, but to live there, we're trying to build this thing. If it's not possible because of the cost of insurance, both in the construction process and subsequently in the living process, we're sunk. And I think it's a big strike against the cities of Oregon or any other cities in Oregon or in the country if we can't have some kind of a rapprochement with the insurance industry. So I think this bill is a step in the right direction. I could wish that the statute of limitations extended longer than it does, as somebody's going to live in one of these things and has every intention of working hard to see that it's maintained on a monthly basis, daily basis for that matter. So I have a level of support for it. I could wish it were more, but perhaps it's the beginning of the industry's beginning to work with homeowners and having some team approach to solving the problem. I'd like to think so.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Senator Stern.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the assessment. I appreciate the bill. There's a reason why insurance rates have gone up a lot in this arena, hasn't it? Been because there's been a lot of trouble with condominium construction, and there's been a ton of claims to relate to defect. I mean, it seems like I heard a story of a recently completed building in the Pearl that had some defect that costs millions of dollars, and that, if I remember right, the windows were installed wrong or something, and they had to basically tear off the entire outside of the building and redo the whole thing. I mean, those are the kinds of reasons why you have such high insurance rates. Is there something else besides that?
Well, I think, I mean, I'll just speak to one part of it, and maybe John can chime in. If there is a construction defect, ultimately the builder, developer, architect are stepping up and having to pay for those defects. I personally not been in a lawsuit yet. I'm trying to build responsibly. We go in and we address those construction defects. What occurs, the bigger ticket items come, and those construction defects are easily able to be seen in the first few years. The more expensive ones, and they get fixed. There was one in the paper recently you might have seen in the Oregonian. They knew about those problems right away, and the builder had to go in and fix those. It's the ones where the buildings aren't properly maintained, where a caulking joint isn't seen and water's going in over a long period of years. It goes out a long time because there isn't a proper maintenance plan for the building that really become expensive. And those are the ones that are the greater cost. And so we think that putting a good maintenance program into place will drastically reduce the number of those larger ticket claims that we see.
May I just make a brief comment? This effort here is in no way intended to avoid responsibility. The second point is that in addition to educating the homeowners association about maintaining their building, there is an equal opportunity to educate the trades, educate the architectural community, the general contractors on systems that do operate properly. We can't suggest, or we're not going to suggest, that we're looking to avoid that educational process with the development team. Absolutely not. At the table, as we put together this maintenance protocol, is the contractor, the architect, and the subcontractors, because they have to continue increasing their standards, raise the bar, if you will, to shortstop the very experiences that you're referencing.
Any other questions? Thank you all very much. What I'm going to do is... unless there's radically new information, I'm going to close the public hearing because I've got to move on at the moment. So, in fairness to all the people that we have here for other bills. So, I'm going to close the public hearing at this point on Senate Bill 955. Members, we'll return now that everybody's back to Senate Bill 55 and open a work session on Senate Bill 55. Senator Atkinson, you were out of the room at the time. This was the consensus bill that we had. We had on updating the rules of surveying and other issues.
Are we in work session, Mr. Chair?
We are, and we have a dash 2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 55.
Senator Starrs moved the dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 55. Discussion?
Which groups were involved in this bill?
Do you want me to read it?
So we learned, don't we? Any other comments? Objections? The word.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 55 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 55 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Other than Senator Decker, objection? So ordered. Anybody like to carry this bill? Who's into meets and bounds? Okay, Senator Starr will carry. Now we're going to open a public hearing, Senate Bill 214. And ask that Robert Roth and John McCauley, Katie Cannon, come forward. While they're doing so, members, as you know, with the Senate deadlines, with very few exceptions, are to have moving Senate bills by the 8th. And so after today, we have two more committee hearings, and there is a strong likelihood that on Thursday, which is the deadline day, that we may come back at 5 o'clock for any bills that we haven't got through that we want to get through. So hopefully, one reason we're trying to organize this so that doesn't have to happen, but if at all possible, we would please kind of keep that open on the deadline day where we may come back at 2 hours later and finish up some bills. So, but we're trying to do what we can here not to have that happen. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Roth, Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Attorney General Hardy Myers. Thank you for the opportunity to address the merits of SB 214. I have submitted written testimony that deals with a number of the details of the legislation. The only thing I'd like to, I guess, say in a way of an overview is that I think there are three main benefits to Oregon's economy from this measure. First, door-to-door sellers who want to comply with the law now have to face the fact that there are two conflicting requirements. There's a requirement for notice by under Oregon law, and there's a requirement under the FTC rule, and the notice requirements are somewhat different. This bill would conform them and consequently take care of that issue for those businesses that are doing business in that way. And if I could kind of move laterally for a moment to talk about the amendments, because I understand you have a letter from Hal Scoggins, an attorney with Farley Witt, who represents one of the businesses that are affected in the way that I'm describing. He talks in his letter in some detail about how we've worked with him on behalf of his client to conform the Oregon law under this bill to the FTC rule requirements for notice. And he's authorized me to say, because we had some email after he sent you the amendments in his Exhibit C, there are a couple of typos and so forth, but the amendments in the dash one amendments that are going to be before the committee essentially incorporate everything that is in the concerns of the UCFS that are described in that letter. So for what it's worth, I'm prepared to cut to that and at least maybe save you a little time, or at least talk further about it if you want some more detail. The second major benefit is that businesses in Oregon now lose sales to unfair competition when there are sellers who come in and don't comply with the Oregon statute. And it now covers only sales that are made in the home, sales that are done door-to-door. And what's happened in recent years is that people who used to sell door-to-door have found ways of getting people to come out of their homes, send them a postcard, we've got a gift for you, you have a new baby, and so forth, get them to come to a motel room or some other temporary location, give them a hard sell sales pitch, and get them into a contract for something they don't want, don't need, can't afford. It's often bad merchandise, you know, just not always, but I mean, but people who do that are taking away business from Oregon businesses that are, can stand up to comparison shopping. So people buy from these folks. They don't buy from your Fred Meyer, Meyer and Frank, you know, some of the other stores around. And by covering some additional transactions, I think this bill will be a benefit to those Oregon businesses. Thirdly, the bill would be, and it, as Oregon law now is, the protections under the bill would be entirely self-enforcing. There would be no need for a nickel of government money or public resources or state agencies to be involved in enforcing it. It's something the buyer can do for themselves, and that's the way the bill, that's the way the law now operates, and that would remain the same with this bill. All 50 states have three-day cancellation provisions similar to those in the FTC rule. The commission has recognized the need for dual enforcement under state and federal authorities because basically they can only deal with the very biggest cases and the ones of broad geographic impact. And so there's a need for local as well as federal enforcement. And there are, as I said, these statutes in all 50 states. So the bill would cover the ground, as I said, that the FTC rule was amended in 1995 to cover the additional kinds of temporary location transactions that I described, the motel rooms and the rest of it. What this bill would do is to bring Oregon law up to date and do the same thing here. Thank you, and if you have any questions, I'll be happy to respond. Oh, and I guess I should also say, in the -1 amendments, the bulk of those amendments have to do with the issue I mentioned about the conflict between state and the state requirements and the FTC rule requirements in the notice. But there are a couple of others that I've been told I should explain. There is a specific exemption. I have some question about whether sale, in my own mind, about whether sales at convention centers, fairgrounds, and so forth would be involved here because I don't think they're personally solicited in the way that others are. But in order to make that clear, and because there are protections under Chapter 565 for sales at fairgrounds governed by the fairgrounds run by the state fair and by the county fairs, we have put a specific amendment in to make it clear that there's an exemption for sales made at events governed by ORS Chapter 565. I think that covers the ground, and you know, unless you have any questions.
Thank you for the summary, and I think that is why the two people to your right are here. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John McCulley. I'm representing the Oregon Fairs Association. We were interested in Senate Bill 214 because, as originally drafted and as it exists now, fairgrounds would be included under the requirements of the statute, and we were very concerned about the impacts this could have on fairgrounds, which we think are more akin to a shopping mall where people might come and expect to buy something or be approached to buy something, not the quote high pressure quote trick sales that Mr. Roth may have been talking about here. So we didn't believe that fairgrounds should be covered under the bill. We're also concerned about if fairgrounds were covered, the impact it would have on the vendors who come to the fairgrounds, and then the notice requirements they would have, the negative impacts it would have on their businesses, and consequently the ability of fairgrounds to attract vendors to come to their facilities, mostly during the off-season when fairgrounds depend to a large degree on revenues that are generated when the fair isn't going on. And so we worked with the Department of Justice on the amendments that you have before you as the -1 amendments, and just want to state that we really appreciate the work of Mr. Roth and the Department of Justice in helping us work through the issues that we saw in this bill.
Thank you. Got a nod, Ms. Cannon?
Yes, for the record, my name is Katie Cannon. I'm the director at the Oregon State Fair, and yes, I am in support of the amendment, the Dash 1 amendments, for the reasons that John indicated and the fact that goods and services is a pretty broad definition for our business. And we've really experienced very few problems out of 2,500 companies that we've had at the fair since 1998 that vend out there. We've had two of them the Department of Justice have shut down. And so we have several checks and balances that we do to ensure that the people that are out there that are conducting business in a responsible manner.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Should be noted, Senator Cruz has now joined the committee, and we welcome him here. Questions for...
A question on this bill.
we don't welcome him.
We take a vote on that.
Questions from the committee? So we are, just again for the record, we're basically making sure that we're conforming Mr. Roth, the FTC definitions and our definitions of this.
Yes, sir.
Yes. Okay.
Chair?
Yes.
Thank you.
I do want to. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 214, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 214, and we have a Dash 1 amendment.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Starr.
Move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill, whatever it is, 214.
Senator Starr has moved the Dash 1 amendments to whatever it is, Senate Bill 214. Discussion. Objection. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill as amended to Senate 4 with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 214 as amended to the 4 with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Objection. So ordered.
Senator Cruz. I nominate Senator Cruz to carry this.
We have Senator Cruz carry this bill? We're going to ask Senator Cruz to carry this bill as a reward for his visitation to the committee today.
That's why he came in. He asked
Ms. Van Winkle will provide you with the material for the floor.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Is it a good bill?
Well, you'll find out.
Okay, well, there you go.
I file a minority report.
We will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 997 and ask that Daryl Fuller and Cheryl Pellegrini come forward. You're not Cheryl Pellegrini. You're right.
Do they want to talk or do they want this bill?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Daryl Fuller and I represent the New Car Dealers Association. I want to let you know that I bought Ginsu knives, carnauba wax for my wife, my car, and a home salsa maker at the state fair, and they all continue to work very well. Mm-hmm. We have before you Senate Bill 997 with Dash 1 amendments that we received yesterday afternoon. The Dash 1 amendments, unfortunately, do not do exactly what we hoped they would. So we're going to discuss with you the deal that the Attorney General and the auditors have come up with that we hope to reduce to amendments as quickly as possible. Essentially, auditors charge customers a fee for processing the title and registration paperwork that they're required to do in order to have the car titled and registered in their name. We charge that fee to almost all of our customers, but customers who pay cash for their vehicle have always had the right to demand the title from the previous owner to process the paperwork on their own. A related issue is that dealers can electronically process the paperwork directly through DMV through an electronic vehicle registration process. We also charge a fee for that. But that fee is not set in statute. It's a service that we provide customers, and we can charge customers whatever the customers are willing to pay. The Attorney General's office has an interest in having that fee capped because they don't want consumers to be ripped off by an exorbitant fee for electronically filing the paperwork. At the same time, dealers have an interest in processing all of the paperwork for their customers because there are a number of advantages to having the dealers do the paperwork processing for the customers rather than giving them a title and assuming that they'll title the vehicle in their own name. So we've negotiated an agreement where we've agreed to cap the electronic vehicle registration fee at $25 beyond the $50 title and registration processing fee, and the Department of Justice will remove their objections to us processing the paperwork on behalf of customers who pay cash for their vehicles at the time of the sale. That is the essential nature of the agreement. The amendments almost get us there, and we're going to continue to work with legislative counsel to bring amendments to you that will complete the negotiated agreement. And I'll be happy to answer any questions you have.
Yeah, Mr. Fuller, just on the Dash 1 amendment, what is lacking there? What are we still trying to solve here?
Well, the big part that is lacking is that there's a statute. When the DMV was given authority to allow private enterprise to conduct business for them, whether it's somebody offering snow park permits or whatever they do when a private enterprise is involved in offering a government service, the private enterprise can charge a fee for that. And part of that legislation in 1997 was that the state cannot mandate what that fee is going to be, that that would be a market-based fee. We have agreed with the Department of Justice on the electronic vehicle processing part of that, that we will actually allow government to cap that fee at $25. The amendments do not refer back to that statute that says that the government can't cap that fee. There has to be an addition to the amendments that says that government can, in this case, cap that fee. Otherwise, you have one statute that says we're capping it and another statute that says that you can't cap it, and the two of those have to be reconciled.
Okay. Thank you for the explanation. Hello.
Hi. For the record, my name is Eva Terrez. I am here on behalf of DOJ, the Consumer Protection Financial Fraud Section.
And for the record, the DOJ is?
Oh, sorry, the Oregon Department of Justice.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Mr. Fuller has stated the position that we have agreed with his association on the general basis of these of this bill, and there are just a few amendments that we want to work out. DOJ has long held the position that absent a third-party lien holder, a buyer who purchases a car for cash should have the option of filing their own paperwork at DMV and should not be required to pay a dealer to perform that function. We have received information from the Oregon State Police indicating that the failure of a car buyer to properly effect a transfer of title and registration has become an increasing problem, and one which has public safety implications, such as abandoned vehicles left on a roadway present a hazard to drivers, and the purchase of a vehicle with cash for the evident purpose of using the using that vehicle for the furtherance of criminal activities. So as a result of these public safety considerations, DOJ has agreed to revise its position. We do not object and take a neutral position on the changes reflected in this bill that would permit dealers to charge buyers for processing these fees, for either properly submitting the documents to effect the change of title and registration or for providing license plates through the EVR program. And buyers will be able to elect which one of these two options they would like to take.
Thank you. I had one question, and either one of you or both could answer. When this transfer is being taking place, it's either I buy a car and you're going to process this, am I told as the consumer what that fee is and proactively said this is what we're going to do and this is how much it's going to cost? I mean, are they informed of that at the time?
Mr. Chairman, it is required to be disclosed on the contracts.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Decker.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know. The panel can tell me. If we want to move this thing along, effective in the House, I'm comfortable. I don't know if that, I know we're working under deadlines, and I don't know if that gives angst to the two, but I think this is a simple enough deal that if their trust is high here and if they're there,
I think what we're going to do, Senator Deckard, and I agree with you, and that's one reason in talking to the proponent of the bill that we would have the public hearing today so that we could, as soon as we had the warm little paper in our hand on Tuesday, move the bill out. So, but that way we wouldn't have to postpone this to do that. So that's why we decided to have the public hearing today so we could have the issue and we wouldn't have to then discuss the merits on Tuesday. So I appreciate that. We are trying to move forward on it. And we should have that amendment.
Senator Deckard, we appreciate your willingness to help us move it along.
Yeah, and hopefully we will have that amendment and we will move this out immediately on Tuesday afternoon. So, any other questions? Okay. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 997 and we'll close the committee. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.